Well, this morning, as we come to a text that is probably familiar to most, if not all of you, I want to take it up under a few headings. We're going to take it a little bit in a strange order here, but I think it does make sense. We'll know by the end of this 25, 30 minutes whether it's true or not. But I want to take it up under the heading of two complaints, and then two clues, and ultimately two categories. You'll note both in this text and the ones that are both preceding and following that they are driven, primarily, Christ's dialogue in particular, are driven by complaints that come to him. This is no exception in this call of Levi. Christ has come to Levi and called him, and we see the first complaint is simply this, that Christ is with the wrong crowd. What we can gather by the language used here concerning Christ's call to Levi, it says here he's a tax collector. If you look at it specifically, he's what we would call a tax farmer. That may sound strange to us, but not like agrarian tax farmer. But, you know, this isn't someone who works directly, for instance, for the government. He's someone who works on contract for the government. He is bid to receive a governmental contract in order to become a tax collector. So it would work like this. Rome would have its territory under this particular section, under the leadership of a Jewish leader as well, Herod Antipas, and they would say, we need to collect at least this much from you. And then those regions would go up for bid, and whoever was the highest bidder, as long as that number matched what Rome said they needed from that territory, that bid then went to the person who made gave the highest number. Once they've paid Rome their particular offer for the bid, they're done interacting with Rome, and now it is their duty for the rest of the year to extract not only the amount that they've given to Rome, but of course, the amount that they want to live on top of that. They need to also make a living with this particular avenue for vocation. And so a tax farmer would pay the government, but then he would go and extract monies not only for what the government needed, but for what he needed to live. Well, it shouldn't surprise us, that these guys were fairly unpopular. They had no, franchise tax board as they walked by to say, this is the set percentage of income tax that you're going to pay me. They would literally have changing rates every time that a fish, every time a catch was made on the sea and was brought in, there would be your local tax farmer saying, yeah, you're going to have to pay me X amount for this that you're about to go sell at market. And so as someone, who's living not only among your people and trying to earn your own wages, you'd be frustrated by the fact that you're getting skimmed. What made it all the more egregious is that you're working or you're having to pay someone who's among your own people who has now sold himself out to a government that you can't stand. They have a foreign occupier ruling over their land, and now you have worked, in conjunction with them to not only extort money for this foreign occupier, but to extort money for yourself. So while they were rich, tax farmers usually, it also came at a price. Their countrymen considered them the vilest of men. Worse than you feel about your friend that just started selling Amway. It's that, and then add to that. In the rabbinic writings, they're linked to such notables as murderers and robbers. And even in the gospel, you'll notice the kind of company they keep when they're used as descriptors. It's always tax collectors and prostitutes, tax collectors and sinners. They don't make good lists. It's not, the celebrities, rich people, and tax collectors. They're always on the bottom rung of the descriptors of those who have no standing in society. And it wasn't just the Jews that viewed them this way. Even the Greek writer Lucian wrote in the first century, tax collectors are ranked with adulterers, panderers, flatterers, and sycophants. See, these men were outcasts, and in particular, they were outcasts in Jewish society. If you took this position as a Jew, you were no longer even eligible to ever serve as a judge in society, but also you weren't even allowed to give testimony in the law courts because you were so distrusted by your fellow citizens. You were excommunicated from synagogue. Your family treated you as a disgrace. It was something that really did come with a heavy social price, even though it came also with a pretty fat paycheck. You know, it wasn't simply that they were skimmers and cheats and treasonous, but they were unclean. They had sided against God and his people, is the way it was felt, at least in the society. And to make matters worse, for Jesus anyway, he not only calls someone like Levi, after he calls Levi, Levi invites him over to his home where Levi throws, what we are told in the text, a great feast. He has a party with all of Levi's friends. Well, what kind of friends would tax collectors have? You'll notice nobody respectable in society is going to hang out with tax collectors. So you notice how Luke describes it. His friends were other tax collectors and other people, which meant all those who didn't really care about fitting in, at least with righteous society. You know, this is more like the scene, at the cantina in Tatooine than it is, you know, a scene of like a royal wedding. This is the kind of people that most people don't want to associate with. But here sits Jesus eating with sinners. That sounds nice. I mean, we like the sound of that, Jesus eating with sinners. But before we rush past it and make it like real acceptable for us, Jesus is a friend of sinners. We like that. We'll sing about it. We need to feel the weight of it. In that he's not just there sitting with sinners, he's having a meal with them. And a meal in this culture is never simply just food. It's not just a time of eating. You know, we may go have lunch and there's no social significance to it. You just had lunch. But here, who you ate with was a symbol and one that carried a lot of weight about who you felt was inside, was okay, was acceptable. You know, the dining table was a place that designated very clearly who's in and who's out, who you're okay with and who you will eschew because of their, you know, nefarious associations. You know, maybe you have people that you wouldn't have in your home either, but this meal is loaded with messages, and the messages have to do with honor and social rank and purity and holiness, and primarily because they believe God was always at table with you, so whoever you associated with, whoever you touched food with, you became a part of that person. So if they're unclean, you're unclean. If God is there and he's dissatisfied with that person, he's dissatisfied with you. And so for Christ to sit down at this table again is not just a lunch because he's doing someone a service. It's his way of saying he's associating with this kind of rabble. The meal was a place where a good Jewish person drew the line. And Jesus clearly is not drawing lines, at least not correctly. And thus he's jeopardizing not only his standing, but I mean, think about it. If he's trying to get his message out and for it to be potentially acceptable to the masses, this is a terrible way to do it, because you're going to offend all the right kind of people in society, or at least those who are viewed as good or in high standing in society. I think it's hard for us to get just how repulsive this is culturally. So let me try. 2014, a documentary was made by a Scandinavian couple under the title Pervert Park. And it's about a particular trailer park in Florida that is a transition home for all people, all committed felon sex offenders who are transitioning out of prison back into general society. And they're here housed all in the same trailer park, kind of among their fellow lepers, if you will. No one else wants them in their neighborhoods, and so here they are stuck with one another. And the AV Club writes an article in reference to this particular documentary, and the author writes this: "The occupants here adhere to a strict curfew, guest policies, and many participate in group counseling sessions designed to help them integrate into life outside of prison. All of this seems to have created an environment of self-reflection and even repentance. Accepting responsibility, one man says, becomes probably the single most important thing that people in my situation can do." Pervert Park reflects that sentiment in the blunt and often painful confessionals that it captures. "It's heavy stuff," says the author. "Somehow made even more difficult to watch through the implicit compassion of the filmmakers. Whether there is such a thing as too much compassion really is the bigger question. End quote. I think this is a segment of society that all of us would tend to agree is the wrong group. And no doubt we wouldn't, you know, necessarily want them in our neighborhood. And there would surely need to be a certain amount of wisdom in discerning how to minister to such a group of offenders. But I wonder if we agree with the sentiment that there is such a thing as too much compassion, especially for the wrong sorts of people. Well, Jesus is showing compassion to a group that generates that kind of disdain societally. Again, I don't think I can stress enough the way that tax collectors were viewed in this particular time period. So he's with the wrong crowd, but also you'll notice they have the wrong disposition. You know, there's these two complaints, and the second complaint is this, that Jesus' disciples don't fast. You know, John's disciples fast and the Pharisees' disciples fast. Why is it that your disciples are just eating and drinking? I mean, they're sitting here at this party and they don't seem to have any care about holiness and restriction. You know, if you're going to be taken seriously, then surely a bit more sobriety in your presentation would be good, especially in light of the company you're keeping. I mean, it's one thing, okay, you cross the road to the wrong side of the tracks, but at least don't show yourself as fully enjoying, you know, your time over there. This complaint arises because Luke tells us that as Levi moves from his task booth to the house, he throws, quote, a great feast. And you'll notice Jesus doesn't require this man who just moments ago was ripping off his own countrymen for profit. He doesn't require him to go some long period of remorse and grieving over his past deeds. He lets him throw a party as if that's totally acceptable. He accepts the invitation. He joins in the celebration, and so do all of his disciples. I mean, we might say the forgiveness part is okay. But I mean, public rejoicing is a bit in your face when your neighbors know that the food that you're eating is afforded because you've been ripping them off for all these years. I mean, again, you've got to feel the weight of what Christ is willing to put himself in the midst of if you're going to understand the point that he makes. Jesus accepts the invitation, considers the party completely appropriate for what just transpired, and the Pharisees and the crowd stand at a distance, shaking their collective heads. Well, if those are the two complaints, the answers to the complaints tell us a lot. And that's what I want us to see next in these two clues. The two clues come, you'll notice, with two images. First, Christ says, I'm a doctor and I'm here for the sick. When asked why he eats with tax collectors and sinners, his answer is direct. The healthy, well, able-bodied, able-minded folks do not need a doctor. It is only the sick and the unhealthy who are in need of a physician. And while that tells us something about the sort of people that Jesus is calling, which will be one of his main points, it also tells us how Jesus chooses to self-identify. A term very, you know, appropriate for our day and age. He identifies himself in this particular story as a physician, a doctor who is here to put something in order. But notice he answers the second complaint with another clue. When questioned about his partying followers and why they choose to indulge so much instead of fasting and withholding, Jesus not only tells us that the sort of response they have is right, namely they're joyful, that's what they should do, that they should be joyful, they should be celebrating. He tells us that he is likened to a bridegroom, and the reason the people must party is because they are guests, and he is the guest of honor, the bridegroom headed toward a wedding. Now these two images, while wonderful metaphors, are not neutral ones. Again, Jesus isn't just plucking these out of thin air. Like, you know, I'm a doctor here for six people. You know, it's like, what's the only party I could think of? A wedding party, you know. Again, he's pulling these metaphors out because he's trying to associate himself with something specifically and causing or forcing those who are hearing him to agree with his identity, the way that he is self-identifying. I mean, the two images come to us, no doubt, from the Old Testament. God, when he redeemed Israel in the Exodus from chapter 15 on calls himself the healer of Israel. He is the one that has bound them up in their sickness. And once he has redeemed them, his desire is for them to be whole. But Israel, because of her rebellion, because of her love for idols, has become sick, according to the Old Testament, from head to foot. God called all of her rebellion sickness. And she looked and she tried in all of her sickness and exile, and no one could heal her. Even Jeremiah, we read this morning, right? He says, is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there at all who will heal my people? So there they are, sick because of their sin, and God, who has always been their healer, is saying, where is the one who will come to heal you now that you're sick and in exile and distanced from me? And of course, in the Old Testament, there's only one husband to Israel, and that is God himself. A God who eventually, because of his unfaithful wife, will divorce her in Hosea and cast her aside, and she will go into the nations and ultimately, you know, be dispersed there, awaiting a time when she would be regathered to be married. In that exile, there would be no joy, there would be no rejoicing, no wedding parties, but there was a promise that one day God would restore her, he would heal her, he would marry her again, and then rejoicing could take place in Israel. There's a lot of images in the Old Testament that describe this, but let me read just one. For as a young man marries a young woman, so shall your sons marry you, speaking of the land. And as a bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so shall your God rejoice over you, speaking of the return of Israel to God her maker. And Jesus, sitting in this party with sinners, says, it's totally natural for me to be here because I'm a doctor that's here for the sick, and it's only right that my friends party because I'm about to get married. I mean, the Old Testament left the nation of Israel sick, divorced, naked, and in mourning, and the only hope they're given is that someday God will come to Israel and he'll do something new for Israel. And Jesus shows up, you know, with a stethoscope around his neck, a wedding ring in his hand, a white dress hanging in the dressing room, and invitations to the receptions that includes an open bar paid for at his expense. And some people sit at the table, eating, drinking, laughing, and enjoying it all. And others stand outside, disgusted by the presentation, unwilling to join the party. Well, if those are the two clues, then we conclude with two candidates. You'll notice Jesus says something that in one instance we love and in the next we hate, but hear it for what it is. Jesus first says, I didn't come for everyone, which doesn't sound like Jesus. We don't, this is not the way that we expect him to talk, but he speaks in the negative. He says very plainly, I did not come for everyone. There are specific people I'm just not interested in helping. I'm not here to help the righteous. I'm only here for sinners. Notice, not everyone can come to the party. It's exclusive. You know, an exclusivity, in one sense, is exactly what the Pharisees are all about. There are sinners and there are righteous people. If you stay away from the sinners, then you can be with us in our righteousness, and God will be pleased with you and with us because we're the right kind of people doing the right kind of thing and staying away from the wrong kind of people who are surely doing the wrong sort of thing. And Christ says, I'm interested in exclusivity too. There's the right group and there's the wrong group. You know, it's not just the Pharisees who function that way. We're built that way. You know, we all want to be in the right kind of place. We want the right social connections, the right associations, you know, the beautiful, the washed, the righteous. We all want to draw lines. And of course, we all want to be in the inner circle once those lines are drawn. And we have an amazing way of drawing the lines in such a way that we're always in. And other people are out, whatever their issue or deal might be. Well, Jesus is making his inner ring. And he says very plainly, I did not come for righteous people. I only and exclusively came and will associate with sinners. He comes surely for the weak and the sick and the outcast and the needy and the poor. No doubt he comes for them. But he also comes, according to what he says here, for the cheats and the corrupt, the selfish, the greedy, and the contemptible, who are so contemptible that they can sense their condition. You see, one of the beauties about being a tax collector, at least when Christ comes in his ministry, is tax collectors never imagine themselves to be okay with society. They always knew they were on the outside. They lived in Pervert Park, you know. They knew that everyone felt that they were dirty. And they knew that if it ever came out what they were or who they would always be on the outside, which made them prime candidates for Jesus, because he said, I'm only coming for broken and ugly sinners. Righteous people, you have to stay out. And so tax collectors, of course, rejoice when his offer comes. He comes for any who associate themselves as sinful. Which, of course, as soon as Christ says that, demands that we self-identify immediately in some way. We pick a side. We pick a place that we belong. Are we in or are we out? Are you righteous or are you sinful? And the only way in, the only way you're ever going to know Jesus, the only way you're ever going to be okay with him is to associate yourself with the bad guys, right? To take up residence in the trailer park and to say, these are my people. Which, of course, is fine, right? We're in church, so we'll say we're sinners. As long as the sinners aren't gross things, you know, as long as they're respectable sins that we can all kind of hold in common. I'm greedy, you're greedy. We're all greedy, you know. You know, I lose my temper. But when Christ says we're sinners, he's as disgusted by those things that you brush off as you are disgusted by the things that that you see in people that are outside the circles of acceptance that you hold. I mean, he sees your sins like tax collector sins. And of course, the good news about that is those are the sorts of people that he says he's attracted to. The hardest thing for the human heart to do, of course, is to call itself a sinner and actually mean it. Again, not in some kind of broad brush sort of way, I'm a sinner, but to really feel yourself to be disgusting and vile and something that God should have nothing to do with if he had good taste and high morals, right? The kind of people that you wouldn't associate with, God is not ashamed to associate with if they can sense their need. Well, you'll notice there's two categories, but those two categories come, the righteous and the sinner, because and are explained when these other two categories or these other two covenants are talked about. You'll notice in this parable that Christ gives as we close that there's this old and there's this new, and they can't go together. They just can't fit. You can't take a new piece of unshrunk cloth and put it to patch an old garment because you're just going to destroy both. The new will pull the old and tear it apart. You can't put brand new wine in used and aged and brittle wineskins because the new wine, as it's fermenting, will break through the skins and destroy them both. Luke uses the word new here in this text more than he'll use it in the rest of his whole gospel, and he uses it one other time in the same sense that he uses here, and it's when Christ says, this is the blood of the new covenant. What Luke is getting after here is that whatever Christ is doing is new in the way that the new covenant is new. It's new in the way that Jeremiah promised God would make all things new. It's new in the way that what was formerly the way that God was working is being replaced by something that is expansive and bigger and better. Well, the old, you'll notice, is exactly what the Pharisees are banking on. That first covenant that God placed before Adam and that was renewed with Israel, it comes with a preamble. Here's what I've done for you. I'm the God who's done these things. And here is my law. Here's what I expect of you as a nation. And if you simply will keep my law, there will be blessings if you do good and there will be curses if you do evil. And we know the whole history of that particular story. Do this and you'll have long life in the land. Don't and you won't. And of course, all of Israel ended up in exile, the north and the south. To a man, no one was delivered from God's wrath against the nation who could not keep his covenant. And here the sons of Israel again are seeking to divide themselves between righteous and unrighteous, the doers of the law and the sinful in their midst. even though they've never been able to keep the law fully, not their fathers, not their grandfathers, not their great-great-great-grandfathers, here they are saying, if we just keep trying the same way, and what we'll do as Pharisees, we'll make more laws to add to the law to keep ourselves from breaking that far law that God set by making all these even more stringent laws on this side of things, like fasting 2 times a week like your disciples don't do, in order that we won't offend God, and still believing that that method will somehow work, that they have enough in them to be pleasing to God by simply doing right continuing in that righteousness. And what's interesting about the old that Christ is talking about here is if that's the way you want to operate, if you want to do right in order that God is pleased with you, the old covenant cannot help you. Right? It can only show you things. You'll notice that Israel ends the Old Testament naked and deprived of joy. And what Christ is talking about here, interestingly enough, is there's a garment, one old one, a new one, and there's wine, which is something the Old Testament makes plain. This is all coming with the new covenant. God's going to dress his people, and they're going to rejoice with the new wine. He says, and here it is, and you can't put the new stuff in the old stuff, or it's going to break it to pieces, because the old will just tell you the truth. The old covenant is true and good and holy as God himself. But what the old covenant will tell you is simply this. If you're naked, it will show you your nakedness. If you sinned, it will proclaim the sin you've committed. And it will offer you nothing to wear and nothing to drink and no way out. It will only identify the problem and magnify it until you are desperate and in need. The only way to be saved by that is something new to come, or to intentionally blind yourself in such a way that you can make yourself believe that you're righteous. And we know how that works, don't we? We would never, ever say that we're righteous. We just argue about it all the time. How do we know that we struggle with self-righteousness? Well, we're always comparing ourselves with others as viewed by you and your standard of righteousness. And your standard of righteousness, of course, is mostly the kind of things you do, even though you break that standard all the time as well. But what's nice is, whatever you really don't struggle with, that becomes the greatest standard of righteousness, so that you can see other people who don't do it and say, oh, they do that and I don't do that. Therefore, brownie points for me. I have some standing to live by. And the beauty of that is the more you compare, the more you see their flaws, and the more you can convince yourself that you're actually righteous in some kind of way. And thus the cycle continues. As C.S. Lewis says, all the worst pleasures are purely spiritual. The pleasure of putting other people in the wrong, of bossing and patronizing and spoiling sport and backbiting, the pleasures of power and of hatred, a cold, self-righteous prig who goes regularly to church may be far nearer to hell than a prostitute. Why? Because a prostitute knows she's a prostitute. I mean, Dietrich Bonhoeffer has a passage in one of his books that is one of those things you read it and you think, I don't know how I should feel about this. But he's in Germany and what at that time would be like their red light district. And he says he attended a Roman Catholic mass. Bonhoeffer, not Catholic, goes to the mass. He says, what was amazing is that there were prostitutes and their customers going through the mass. And he said, and this to me was one of the purest pictures of the gospel, because all of the ones in attendance knew that they actually needed prayers. He said, and the one thing a vain man cannot do is truly pray. And that's what Christ is getting after here. As soon as you think you have anything to your account, a way of separating yourself, which the Pharisees were doing, at least we're not like them, he says, as soon as you do that, you disqualify yourself from being a recipient of good news. But instead of the old, you'll notice Christ comes with a new thing. So new that not only can sinners come, they can be seated at the same table as the Lord of the covenant and feast with God himself, laughing and passing the wine bottle as they go. The new covenant is unlike the old in this way, and it tears the old to shreds. The Lord's gifts and blessings in the new covenant are different in this way. They are not conditioned in any way upon your observance on the law. Your goodness will not do. It is not Christ will save you and keep you if you keep being a good boy or girl. The law cannot help in this regard, and if you truly try to keep the law in order to ingratiate yourself to God, it spoils the whole thing. The gospel, what Christ is bringing in the new covenant, is based wholly on God's doing and God's forgiving, not your doing or your righteousness. It is a call to truly lay down your arms and stop engaging in a battle that you are destined to lose if you seek to fight it. In fact, one of the blessings, hear me here, people, as we close, of the new covenant is simply this. The new covenant gives to us what the old covenant required. That instead of making obedience to the law a prerequisite for God's blessing, the blessing of the new covenant is that He will, A, grant us righteousness, and eventually will make us obedient by giving us a new heart unto ultimately a new creation and a resurrection. The one thing He required in the Old Testament, He gifts to us in the new, because we could not do it on our own. In fact, the new is so amazing and so gracious and so secure that we're allowed even now to engage in feasting, because we know that what is ultimate is complete, and that nothing we can do now will add or subtract to the work that Christ has done on our behalf. And while that's amazingly good news, it is only good for those who know and believe that they truly have nothing to offer. The new will not allow any effort or merit. It will not give any trophies or badges. It will not allow you to help just a little bit so you don't feel so guilty for being a deadbeat. You know, the question of the Pharisees show us clearly who Jesus is. He is the great physician. He is God Himself, the bridegroom. And what He is giving away is healing and a wedding and clothes and a party. And what He has come to do is to save, but you must be sick and naked and tired and poor. You cannot be righteous and receive what He's bringing. And that, of course, for us is very, very difficult to accept. I mean, does it bother you to hear about a gospel that is that free? As one author writes, no matter how much we give to the notion of free grace and dying love, we do not like it. It is just too indiscriminate. It lets rotten sons and crooked tax collectors and common tarts into the kingdom. And it thumbs its nose at really good people. And it does that gallingly for no more reason than the gospel's shabby exaltation of dumb trust over worthy works. Such nonsense, we mutter in our hearts. Such heartless, immoral folly. You see, if you're being honest with yourself, it's hard to know you're a sinner. Our common way of acting is self-defense, which is just another way of saying self-justification, or a way of propping up your righteousness. I mean, the reason that your marital fights last longer than 30 seconds is because someone has something to prove, and that something to prove goes to the very core of their being. It's not the issue on the table. It's the issue of, am I okay? Am I an okay person? Am I going to really stand on the last day? And we want so badly for ourselves to be okay that it's hard to just lay down our arms and say, you know what? You're right. I'm angry. I speak ugly. You know, I am lazy. You know, none of us wants to say those kind of things because that's for, you know, losers or whatever is on that. And Christ says, that's exactly right. Those are the only sorts of people I'm come to save. And if you sit here this morning and you sense that your pride has kept you even this week as someone who's fighting and scraping for your own place in the world, then you know you're a self-righteous sinner. And the glory of that is if you know you're a self-righteous sinner and can admit it, then you finally qualify to be in the right category. For Christ does not come for righteous people, only for sinners, even for proud, ugly, content sinners who most of the time believe they're good enough or at least won't tell their nearest neighbors about their true identity. If you're being honest, you're a sinner indeed. And if you are a sinner, then you're just the sort of person that Christ came to save. So may we look to Him afresh this morning as we consider His promises to us in the gospel. Let's pray.